noon, that is, and you are tuned to CFRO Vancouver's Cooperative Radio 102.7 FM. And it's time now for Animal Voices. Here they come.
Yes, and welcome to Animal Voices. Gandhi said, there is little that separates humans from other sentient beings. We all feel pain. We all feel joy. We all deeply crave to be alive and to live freely. And we all share this planet together. Yes, you are listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, also known as Co-op Radio. It's a community-based and community-sponsored radio station, and we are proud of that. Alan Jensen, thank you for being our technician today. My name is Carl Loskin, and in the studio today, we have co-host Marge Adams. Marge, what will you be doing today?
Well, I'm going to be speaking with Annalise Sorg, who is the founder and director of No Whales in Captivity, and she's also the executive director of the Canadian Marine Environment Society. Now, I want to talk to Annalise about the birth of the beluga whale this week in Vancouver at the aquarium. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, thank you, Marge. That's going to be very informing because, it's something that I think everybody should know about what is actually happening in the Vancouver Aquarium in the whale pond. In the second part of the show, we will have Conrad Schmidt from the Workless Party, and he's here already. Conrad, where are you? He's outside getting the coffee. And he has a new video called Workers of the World Relax, the Jevons Paradox. So stay tuned. At half past the hour, we'll have Conrad Schmidt from the Workless Party on. During the past week, there was a remarkable 20-minute documentary on The National, which is CBC TV. What was remarkable about this documentary was that it revealed what was happening to horses. Yes, our beloved horses. And, recently they put a ban on the United States to export horses to Mexico and to Canada. And they put a ban on the slaughter of horses in the United States. Now, wouldn't it be nice if Canada would follow suit? But in fact, what was revealed in this documentary was that these horses were being shipped to Canada under the guise of going for pasture in this country, and in fact, they were destined for the slaughterhouse. The animal transport trucks, it was revealed, were designed to carry cattle, and the horses received severe head injuries as a result of the low truck ceilings. The slaughter stunning systems in the slaughterhouse were also designed for cattle. Severe prodding was required for the animal to be able to reach the stunning device. It was amazing that these good people were able to go in within the slaughterhouses and do this documentary, which hopefully will lead to better legislation. The monitoring by the federal health inspectors, it was shown, was to be totally absent, and the laws outdated. Horse meat is considered to be a delicacy in France and Japan, and it is legal to transport horses in Canada for 36 hours without water, food, or rest stop. Thank you, CBC, for showing this documentary on The National, and thank you, Vancouver-based organization CETFA, which stands for Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals. And they believe that it is time for a change and that the outdated regulations and they lobby to improve the government regulations for the transportation of farm animals. And that can be reached at CETFA, CETFA www.annalise.com. Well, we have a few minutes till Annalise phones. So what we have is, do you have any announcements, Marge?
Well, I don't have any announcements, but I have a couple of interesting items here.
Just fire away, and then I'd like to go on about what historians say about medical testing.
Well, this was a pleasant item on something called Mail Online, and it's about the Canadian beaver. I think of that as our animal. Eager beavers may be breeding after building first dam in England for 800 years. It's the first dam of its kind to be built in all these years, but the pair of beavers responsible for the mud and sticks creation have a great deal more on their minds than any historic achievement. It's because they are about to breed. The pair was brought to Britain from Europe last year, and they're apparently building and doing very well.
It's amazing that it's been like 800 years since there's any beavers there. I was just imagining them swimming up the Thames and clambering around the London lakes and so on and building dams. Anyway, Annalise Sorg is on the line now. Whenever you're ready.
Yes. Hello, Annalise. Are you there?
Good to talk to you.
Well, it's certainly good to have you back on Animal Voices. It's been a long time.
It's been a little while, for sure.
I know how busy you have been. Now, in the last week, there's been a lot of media attention focused on the Vancouver Aquarium because of the birth of the beluga whale. And I would like you to start out by telling us something about belugas and their appearance, their behavior, location, where they live in when they're not in captivity. Could you give us a little background?
Sure. Well, belugas are wonderful creatures, actually. They're one of the few dolphin species that have no dorsal fins. Everybody knows that orca whales, for instance, have a fin that sticks out from their back when they're traveling, and you can see them in the ocean like that. Well, beluga whales are dorsal finless, but they have something that attracts, unfortunately, aquariums around the world to put them on display. They can turn their heads back and forth. It's as if they had a neck. So that makes them, of course, very popular for the aquarium industry, which gets them into trouble as well. They don't grow as large as orca whales. A male beluga will weigh up to 1,000 kilos, but and a female 700 kilos, so they're not as big, which is also something that the aquariums like, because they're able to capture them easier, and of course they capture them as their young calves. Now, most of the belugas around the world are in the Canadian Arctic. There's really no good science that says how many belugas. I've heard from 50,000 to 150,000 belugas around the world. In Canada, there are belugas mostly down in the Hudson Bay, around Churchill, Manitoba, is where they were captured. Certainly the belugas at the Vancouver Aquarium that were captured, that's where they came from. And then they just continued to go higher up to the North Pole, but the populations are smaller and smaller. In the high Arctic, they believe there's probably between 20 and 40,000. But, you know, Marge, the problem with these numbers of wild populations of whales is that they come from federal fisheries. Mm-hmm. And, of course, these animals are hunted. And in order to give hunters larger quotas, we suspect that the numbers are inflated regularly in the sense of populations, because when we talk to independent scientists who do study belugas, they're concerned, and they peg the amount of belugas in the Canadian Arctic at about half of what the government does. So Belugas are in trouble, in the wild, because of global warming. That's something that is affecting everybody on this planet, and of course, the Arctic is warming up at a much faster rate than, for instance, the equator and other places. So we're seeing all sorts of disastrous things happen up there, and we know that belugas, as well as narwhal whales, bullhead whales, polar bears, of course, they're all being affected by this. So it's really a bad time to be an Arctic mammal.
Is there any protection at all offered by our government?
Protection from capture since 1992. What happened back then was four belugas were captured and sold to the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, and as they arrived there, they were injected with this deworming solution that promptly killed two of them. And there was such a huge outcry in Canada for the capture, because it was televised, which is the one and only time, of course, that that's happened, and because these two belugas died in Chicago, that the Federal Fisheries Department reacted by placing a ban on the capture and export of belugas from Canada. So that was really a good thing. However, as you know, there are two facilities in Canada that continue to display beluga whales, and that's the Vancouver Aquarium and Marineland in Niagara Falls. And they are able to continue bringing belugas from other places where they have no protection. For instance, Marineland in Niagara Falls, last time I checked, had imported 26, that's 26, belugas, wild belugas from Russia, from a population that is in dire straits, and there are no protection measures to, for these poor animals. So the trade, the international commercial trade in belugas and dolphins and orcas, et cetera, and marine mammals in general, unfortunately, continues to grow regardless of protection measures that we are able to get here in Canada.
And there's a big price on their head, too, isn't there?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, you know, a baby beluga is probably a couple $100,000, and then if it's an older beluga with a good training pattern, or if she's a good breeder, I mean, you know, they all have a price tag, but rightfully so, this is all done for money.
Absolutely. Now, what about the mother of the offspring that appeared this week? Could you tell us about how she got into captivity and her circumstances?
There's four belugas and one baby right now at the aquarium. So there's five belugas at this point. Three of them were captured off Churchill, Manitoba, and one of them being the grandmother of this baby. Aurora is her name. She was the youngest and smallest, and she gave birth to Kila about 12 years ago. Poor little Kila was born at the aquarium, and Aurora probably had never seen another baby be born, or she was so young when she was captured that she didn't know what to do with the baby. And Kila was swimming around, not being able to call the attention of her mother. Aurora was just stuck to one spot in the tank. And this is very common in captivity, by the way, that, you know, whenever you see whales and dolphins in captivity that are not doing shows, they're just on the surface, floating on the surface, and probably stuck to one spot. I mean, it's horrible to watch. But in any case, Kila was going to starve if the mother didn't start nursing her. Amazingly enough, at that time, there was another beluga at the aquarium called Alua. She had never given birth. She had never been pregnant. And when Alua realized that Kila was not being nursed by her mother, she started producing milk.
Well, for heaven's sakes, amazing.
I mean, yeah. It's unbelievable, but that's what happened, and that's what saved little Keela, was that Alua produced milk and nursed her and weaned her, and Keela was able to survive being an infant, and unfortunately, she was in a tank with the father of this baby whale that was just born on Tuesday, and Keela was got pregnant from him at 6 years old, and she had a miscarriage. That's very, very young for a beluga. I mean, belugas are meant to live almost like humans, to 60, 70 years old, and we consider this a rape, really, to leave the little one with the father there. Now, this little beluga that was just born on Tuesday, she is being nursed, apparently, by Keela, but Keela had the same reaction that Aurora had when she was born, which is she'd never seen a baby whale before, and she ignored the baby and was stuck to a spot. But fortunately or unfortunately, I have mixed feelings, of course, because is it better that this baby survives, or is it better that this baby dies? Mm-hmm. The survival of this baby is probably there's a very slim chance for that, because Keela is the only surviving dolphin species at the aquarium. Six other baby whales and dolphins have died there, have been born and died there. So
it's a pretty discouraging rate of live whales, though, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, this is the thing. They're trying to, they have a breeding program that is just abysmally cruel, right, when, you know, these animals aren't able to survive. And, of course, if you watch the news and seen how the baby was born, I mean, it's amidst a circus. They bring in the media, they bring in the children, there's people screaming and clapping and so on.
300 people were watching in the aquarium, so I read.
Isn't it immoral?
I think so, absolutely.
And then the other thing is that they immediately have to put in 25 divers into the pool so that they can line up this tank so that the baby whale doesn't bump against the tank walls. I mean, there is nothing natural. There is nothing humane. There is nothing ethical about what the Vancouver Aquarium is doing with the belugas and dolphins, that they're trying to breed them, and it's all for money. And, of course, the Vancouver Aquarium is the upper echelon of corporate Vancouver, and there is a lot of money back and forth there, and they do pretend to be a society, but they are businesses. Many businesses run out of there, and they do make a hell of a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is about, Marge, as every other animal issue that you so wonderfully deal with in Animal Voices. I mean, if we could take the money out of abusing animals, you and I wouldn't have to be talking about this, would we?
Well, that's right. Now, how is the baby doing right now? I haven't seen it on television in the last day, I guess. Have you? Is she nursing? And
apparently she is, but you know, this time the media has been absolutely gagged. Your listeners might have noticed, because I have received a few phone calls wondering where is the opposition in this issue at this time, and it's just been incredible. This has never happened to us before. We have been doing this since 1992. And we have received it. The Coalition for No Whales in Captivity has been in the news every time that there has been a problem or a death or a birth or whatever is happening with laws regarding whales in captivity. The media has been very present, very interested, the public certainly very interested. But as the years have gone by, we have realized how our letters to the editors won't be published. And if we phone into the radio stations, they won't let us through. They'll cut us off, etc. Well, in this case, when the baby beluga was born, We did have media that phoned us, and we actually did about 5 interviews, but when those reporters obviously got to their editors, the opposition was nixed. Nothing came out.
Interesting, isn't it? Yeah, you know, this situation with the whales not being able to nurture their young, isn't it just reminiscent of what we were listening to last week regarding the native Canadians and how they were torn away from their families, these children, put in residential schools, held captive for many years? It's just the same thing, and then it goes through the generations. It's not something that's just that child suffers. It's his offspring and so forth, because they don't have the skills needed to live in a loving family and to parent their offspring. I think
absolutely. The whole community suffers, Marge.
Absolutely, for years.
You know, and the community suffers, the planet suffers. There's just no doubt about that. These animals not only are being torn away from their parents in the wild, but later they're torn away from their artificial pods in captivity as well, because as you know, aquariums around the world do play musical whales, if you want to call it that way, just in order to try to breed them, to try to make more money, obviously. So it is a tragedy for all communities, and we all suffer for it, for sure.
Yeah. Now, I know that Vancouverites voted years ago to get rid of the zoo in Stanley Park, and since the aquarium is really an underwater zoo, it has been allowed to continue, and I'm wondering, because I know there's an awful lot of people who just don't believe whales and a lot of other creatures should be held in captivity, how come they are allowed to continue and expand, I might say?
Money.
Do they pay the city?
Money. Sorry, I always go back to the same thing.
Yeah.
This is a corporation. Corporations are put together to make money. There are no ethics involved. There's no concern for communities. I mean, you can call sustainable things, you know, the companies can call themselves sustainable and green and all this, but if their mandate is the same as a corporation, they're there to make money. So what's happened is, you know, the aquarium has been able to, in the 5 last civic elections, which is really how public referendum votes are carried out, which is, as you pointed out, the Stanley Park Zoo in 1993 was closed because Vancouverites voted against keeping these animals in captivity. There was polar bears and seals and monkeys and so on, and they voted against it, and people thought that they were voting against the aquarium and the whales as well being there.
Yeah, it was the captivity issue, I'll bet, they were concerned about, wasn't it?
It was a huge issue,
yeah.
And what the Vancouver Aquarium has managed to do is throughout all these civic elections, they've managed to make the politicians not do what's right and let Vancouverites have a say, but they have made the politicians cater to the Vancouver Aquarium and not only allowed them to continue doing business as usual, but to expand, as you say. I mean, last time I checked their plans, they're going 4 floors below and 7 above in that building in Stanley Park.
Really? Oh, really? Terrible. Well, you know we're out of time, Annalise. I'm sorry to say that, because it's always so interesting to have you on the show. But we will have you back.
Thank you so much. It's always great to be there. And, you know, you guys are doing a great job. Please keep at it.
Well, thank you so much. I know how hard you're working, too.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices on CFR Radio 102.7 FM. And then we have Life Force did a wonderful YouTube, and it's people can go to Life Force and watch this YouTube. It's worthwhile, and it's with music and written word.
She said her name at the end.
And yes, of course, we were speaking to Anneliese Zorg from the No Whales in Captivity. So thank you, Anneliese. And I know you were phoning from the ferry terminal in Horseshoe Bay. So there we go. Alan, do you have a spot of music there? And over to you.
Yes, we'll just have a little bit of music featuring Brad Meldow, a piece called Turtle Town. Brad Meldow is one of the stars coming to this year's Jazz Festival, so he'll be in town in a couple of weeks, and you can go and hear him do Turtle Town.
Sucks computer waste gets stuck in landfills or dumped on poor countries.
Where can I take my old hardware?
Freegee!
Is a volunteer nonprofit run by punks like you. Recycling hardware, sharing skills, and providing access to technology.
Check out freegeekvancouver.org or call 604-879-GEEK.
Free Geek! Helping the needy get nerdy!
Yes, and yes, you're listening to Animal Voices. Within a minute or so, we'll have Conrad Schmidt on the line from the Workless Party. Well, what's happening in the big wide world? Of course, we saw from Anneliese Zorg what's happening at the Vancouver Aquarium, and there is joy in the world, and we all have to accentuate the positive. But before we accentuate the positive with Conrad Schmidt, we also have to see how the world's improved in many ways as far as our longer liberty is concerned. So, and the major historians of medicine are agreed that the improvements in longer liberty are due to are not due to animal-tested medicines and vaccines, but to better sanitation, hygiene, better nutrition, clean water, and other improvements in living conditions. And Lindy Green writes that animal studies confuse every issue and their results will never have scientific precision. The general belief in the value of animal experimentation is the result of what she calls propaganda that the public has submitted to for a long time. Behind it are the pharmaceutical industries, which spend fortunes on publicity and finance the charities. They finance the charities, the research institutes, and the universities. There are today more than 400 experimental methods that don't require the use of animals and that are far more reliable, cheaper, and quicker. But even more important are prevention and the safeguard of human health. Science, as she says, doesn't need animal testing. Business does, as a legal loophole. The laws must be changed, and animal research must be prohibited for a better medicine and healthier humanity. Well, we've been greatly privileged to have Conrad Schmidt from the Workless Party, and he's done a documentary called Workers of the World Relax, The Jevons Paradox. Well, Conrad, you're smiling and happy. So, what is this all about?
Well, first I want to say it's always a great honor to be on your show, and Co-op Radio Station is the best station in the whole world. There's no question about that. And yeah, I just recently finished a new short little documentary. Making that film was more work than any of my other films combined. What I wanted to do was show that the ideas of working less were nothing new, especially in Europe, and even in our own history. And while I was making it, one of the big surprises was when I found that clip from JFK, Kennedy. Do you remember it?
Yes, he said the new era of leisure, and we'd all be just to have machines working for us, and we'll be just sitting at home on the beach and having hot tubs and saunas and drinking.
Well, what he was saying was that we cannot keep on producing so many goods and services as we are in this, with the industrial mechanization, and the only way that we could balance consumption to production was we had to reduce the work week, which is the same thing that we're saying. And even Roosevelt was saying the same thing. It goes back quite a bit. And while I was in Europe making this film, what I wanted to do was contrast the different lifestyles between different countries and put it into a documentary. And I got really, really lucky.
So what are the differences between Europe and Canadian lifestyles?
Well,
we're working more, are we? Yes.
Oh, well, yes, there's a big difference. But let me tell you one of the big surprises the other was in making this film, was I got to interview the former Minister for the Environment in France, Yves Cochet. And he was saying the same things, that you have to reduce the work week. We cannot keep on producing so many goods and services and consuming so many goods and services and expect our ecological footprint to go down. We have to balance production and consumption. We have to start working less and start enjoying other things in life, music, art, family, culture. And the important message is that, now this is an interesting catch, is that you can't really reduce the work week. The reason is that work is something that's always happening. If you're looking after your kids, you're working to raise a healthier future generation. If you're thinking, that's all important work. Rest that your body needs is all important. And all of these things, music, art, family, culture, are essential work that creates a healthier society. If the only work we do is heading off to offices and factories making consumer goods that land up in landfills, firstly, we're damaging the planet, but not only the planet, ourselves as well, because we're not doing valuable work. We're not doing the valuable work of music, art, family, and culture. And so that's what I wanted to do with this piece, was contrast countries that had a reduced work week, like Austria, Denmark, Switzerland, Sweden, Germany. And
maybe mention the figures, because it's so dramatic. I had the good fortune to watch the documentary, and we are working so much more in Canada than the people in Europe, and they're getting so much more time off and holidays.
Yeah, it's a big difference, especially.
Throw out some figures there.
Well, my memory's a little.
We are really workaholics. You know, in Austria, you get 5 weeks holiday.
6 weeks vacation if you stay with the company a longer time, and it's a 37-hour work week. But the big country that has the biggest difference is Norway. Norway, the average Norwegian will work something, I think it's 500 hours less. And then the next one is Holland. I forget the next three. But it's almost like 2 months less. And in Germany, you have 6 weeks vacation, which is guaranteed, and then you get a further 2 weeks. So it's a total of 8 weeks vacation on a 37-hour work week.
Now, Alan, you have a question.
These are paid vacations, right?
Oh, and there was something else that I found just so inspiring. Yes, they paid vacations. Something else that I found so inspiring, and I wasn't really expecting it. But in Germany, on a Sunday, all the shops are closed. You go to a mall, and it's just empty. Like over here, Sundays, it's the holy shopping day.
Well, when I was young, living here, all the shops were closed, too. And there was a big battle. It went on and on and on for a long time, Sunday shopping. But the big businesses wanted it. The small shops didn't want it, because then they had to work 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
But the big stores, the big retail shops, were, you know, pushed, and finally the government went for it. Right?
And so you know what people were doing on their Sundays?
going to the park.
Not just the park. When I went out, there were people that were doing hang gliding. There were people that were going to dance classes or doing music or meeting up with other community people and organizing. And there was a lot of time for people would often do another thing, was go to church as well. There was that part as well. And then it was a day where it was your day. It was a day of no shopping.
Now, Leonardo da Vinci, he wrote many years ago, he said, beauty and vitality are gifts from nature, and those who live by her laws. Are we living by her laws? What are the laws?
I think the laws, that is a good thing. And I think the
laws, I mean, what we see today is infinite growth and a system which is dependent on expansion.
Mm-hmm. And the funny part is when you listen to political leaders and they're all saying the same thing. Well, we can have infinite growth, and green technology is going to be the tool that gives us infinite growth. And everybody's saying, and you've seen that video clip, I've got clips. It's not just the Green Party. I have clips where you can listen to George Bush and Clinton and the rest of them. They're all saying the thing that green growth is coming to the rescue. And that's the idea I wanted to tackle, was that green growth is not really a solution. If you look at what growth, if you look at what technology does, is it increases our efficiency. And an increase in our efficiency means that we can now consume more goods and services. It's called the Jevons paradox. Let me give you an example. Do I have time for an example?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So, okay, this is my favorite example. So in 1970, during the 1970s, the price of oil skyrocketed. And Congress decided, what are we going to do? And they said, well, what we need to do is make cars more efficient. Sound familiar? And so they passed a law in 1975 which guaranteed that all automobiles will be 20% more efficient. Did it work? No, didn't work. By 1990, cars, even though they were 30% more efficient, but the end oil consumption had increased by 9%. And the reason why is that people were traveling more, people were buying more cars. The more efficient things become, the more we use them. And if you look through history, it's the same thing. Like, here's an example. Coal is more efficient than wood. It's actually even less polluting because you don't have to chop down forests. But because it was more efficient, it enabled us to build more industry, ship steam, and we could do so much more with it. And the consequence was consumption increased. Then petrol came along, petroleum, and it was also more efficient. And we could fly further, we could have even more cars, and we could build more, we could have almost more growth. You see, what we've been doing is using efficiency to increase our expansion, our footprint. Increased efficiency means we can consume more. It does not mean that our ecological footprint goes down. And this is old news. Like, I watch video clips while making this film. Like, this was something that was so common in the 1930s and 40s. That you could go and you could watch these information pieces talking about this problem in theaters. And now, not even mainstream academics don't even discuss it anymore. It's like, green technology is coming to the rescue. No. You have to look at the last 200 years of history.
I heard somebody talking just a couple of days ago, and he was bragging about the fact he had a hybrid car. Mm-hmm. But his hybrid car was a 270-horsepower car. And I was thinking, there's something that doesn't compute there, right? I mean, I'm sure it's more efficient than another 270-horsepower car, but who needs 270 horsepower? It's like, it's ridiculous.
And also, like, mm-hmm. when you look at all the research, all the reports, like, for example, a hybrid car. The best thing, if you want to become environmentally friendly and you have this idea that you can change your SUV to a hybrid car and reduce your ecological footprint, no, it doesn't work that way for several reasons. One of which is that when you look at the amount of energy that goes into the manufacturing of the car, the amount of resources that have to be stripped from the earth, the mines that are busy pulling out the ore, the pollution, all that pollution, there's more damage that goes into the manufacturer and disposal. If you're driving an SUV and you think you can reduce your ecological footprint by getting a hybrid, stay with that SUV. And this equation goes on even a little more. here's another interesting aspect to it. So now let's take that equation. This is the part I like the most. Suppose you think, okay, well, in that case, what I need to do is I'll get a bicycle. Do you logically, it sounds that you can reduce your ecological footprint by getting rid of your SUV and getting a bicycle. But no, you have to extend that equation. You see, what happens is if my SUV costs, say, $500, and I now get a bicycle, which costs maybe $10 a month, I now have $490. If I use that $490 to buy a bigger house or go on a European vacation or buy new computer equipment or anything, virtually every one of those aspects actually even has more of an ecological footprint. My ecological footprint will go up. The only way that you can reduce your ecological footprint is taking that, well, there are two ways. Taking that $490 and tearing it up. Or you can walk into your boss's office and say, I would like to reduce my work week. I've got this money. I don't need to buy more consumer goods, but I would like more time for family, music, art, enjoying the people around me, building community. Then you can reduce your ecological footprint. Those are the two ways. Well, oh, yeah, I suppose there is a third way, is you just let the cycle continue and everything collapses, but I'd rather we choose social evolution. Mm-hmm. That's the choice.
I would like to see us concentrate more on health, and in that way we would get out and exercise more. People would not run to their car and drive to the corner store to buy something. That kind of lifestyle needs to go out, mm-hmm. and in return, our bodies improve. Mm-hmm. You're exercised, and you sleep better, and all these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another way you can improve. Alter your values, really.
Exactly.
Look to your health.
And so, yeah, exactly. And so if anybody's interested in watching this short video piece, it's Workers of the World Relax.org, and it's on the internet. You just go Workers of the World Relax. .org. And
I watched it this morning. It is well worth your time. Conrad, it's a superb piece of art. Leonardo da Vinci would agree. But now more productivity, as you've just so explained here so well, means more stuff. And of course, this whole China thing has accentuated it. But on the bigger picture, we're really consuming ourselves out of a planet, aren't we?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we're doing. Is as industry makes us more efficient, it means that with less labor, we can produce more goods and services. So now the cycle continues. Now, if we continue becoming more and more efficient, to balance production, you always have to consume more. And the cycle continues and goes faster and faster until eventually you consume yourself out of a planet. You have to balance the equation. Any increase in technological efficiency has to be offset by increased leisure time and not increased production. And that's the idea that Kennedy was trying to get across in 1963, September.
So it hasn't really worked. It's backfired on his idea that he said there was going to be more leisure time for people in North America. But George Bush, in his quote, and it's on your documentary, of course, is that he equates green growth, which he'd like to jump the bandwagon,
mm-hmm.
but the green growth comes with technology.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you're explaining now in the Jevons paradox.
Mm-hmm.
So are we talking, how do we feel about technology when it's backfiring on us like this?
Yeah, it is very scary that we have almost this unanimous voice that's coming out from academia and politicians with very, very little dissent that the solution is green technology. And there are a lot of respectable voices, important voices, that are saying that it's not possible. And you'll meet a lot of these people in the film. Bill Rees at the UBC is one of them. Yves Cochet is another one of them. And they point out that you can't reduce your ecological footprint by becoming more efficient and producing more goods and services. You have to have a net reduction. It's the only way. And it is scary when you can listen to George Bush and the leaders of environmental movements some very respective environmental movements, and they're sounding way too similar.
Now, Conrad, you have quite a history also. So maybe it's a wonderful documentary. Maybe mention where people can get it at the webpage for the YouTube.
Yeah, making this film was a lot of work, and it was a labor of love. And it's available for free. There's no charge for it. You just go to the website.
What's the website?
www.workersoftheworldrelax.org. And please, if you like the film, forward it to as many hardworking people as possible, because we definitely need to get the idea that it's time for other types of work, like music, art, family, culture, the things that create a happier, healthier society with less of an ecological footprint.
Now, I'd like to go into a bit of your history. Of course, you were born in South Africa of German extraction. We have that in common. I'm Carl Helmut Lotzken.
And I'm Conrad Schmidt from South Africa.
Schmidt is a Schmidt? Is a
blacksmith.
Blacksmith. Hard workers, aren't they? Working under fuming and fiery conditions in blacksmith shops. Mm-hmm. So you started the Workless Party as well, and you ran for political office.
Oh, I've never run for political office. Our mayoral candidate is the incredible, the notorious, the one and only Betty Croswick. We figured that we wanted someone we could trust, and someone that's willing to stand up. There's nobody that I know that is willing, who has put more on the line than Betty Croswick. I mean, she's put her life at risk. She's been in jail for over 3 years. She's willing to fight for, she's willing to stand up for what she believes in, which is so different in the political framework these days.
Uh-huh. So she's running for?
Mayor.
Mayor of Vancouver. So we know where to vote for. But Betty Croswick, and also she was involved in, she was in prison for a lengthy period of time, standing up against the loggers.
Mm-hmm. Multiple times. Betty is, I don't remember how many times she's been arrested for stopping logging and destruction of the planet.
It's not stopping logging. Let's put it, preserving the first growth rainforest. It's very clear.
You know what I find just so strange, just so it always gets me, it gives me the giggles, is that they throw her in prison and they lock her away for long periods of time. The last sentence was 10 months. And they do it at the same time as they put in Victoria there's a museum, mm-hmm. and it's got this huge picture of Betty and a story, and they put her in the museum at the same time as they lock her in jail. It's just so confusing where we are on an environmental perspective. We say, wow, she's a great environmental hero. We love Betty. Let's lock her in jail.
Now, the Workless Party is actually a registered political party, is it?
Yes.
And so you're going to be, your vision is to run in the federal election?
We're going to run in all three elections. We feel that it's very important to get the ideas across because, I mean, these are so not new ideas, and I feel that a lot of respected voices out there, academics and politicians, have been very marginalized for saying that we have to slow down. And the only academics that seem to get into the newspaper these days are those that are willing environmental activists. The only environmental economists, academics, that get into the newspapers are the ones that are willing to toe this the government and corporate idea that that the only way we're going to solve our problem is that continuous growth is going to that we can have continuous growth by making with this new green technology. And anybody that else that says you can't have continuous growth and that you have to balance any increase in technological efficiency by increased leisure time gets extremely marginalized. And there are so many voices that have been saying it for so, so long. There's so much history in it. And when you do a comparison between different countries that do have a reduced work week where people have time for music, art, family, culture, and community, they do have lower crime rates. They have more social conscience. They've higher, in the developed world. And even the same thing even applies in developing countries. And it shows that people really do need time to create a healthy society. Mm-hmm. And what we have over here is growing crime rates, higher incarceration rates, increased poverty, and it's not working.
In our part of the world, a big problem is that mainstream media does not carry so many of these ideas. In the previous interview, we were talking about the killer whale, or the whales, the beluga whales, and the fact that the information about this whale is not being picked up by the mainstream media, right? They just don't put it out there, so people don't hear it. And all of the ideas you're talking about also are just not picked up. Like, it's interesting that in Europe this is happening. Obviously, people talk about it in Europe, and it would be a subject for discussion in the media. But in our part of the world over here, it is not. You know, we are not served well by mainstream media in this country.
Actually, I had a small correction on that last one. I was surprised while I was there. It's actually something that's not discussed. It's just something that's assumed. And then when I'm interviewing people, I say, did you know that in the United States they only get 2 weeks vacation and only 14% actually take it? They get this. Only 14% actually take their 2 weeks vacation.
That's amazing.
You saw that clip. You saw that clip when they went,
you know why? They fear that when they go away too long, somebody else might either like their job or do it better. They're going to come back to secure their job. They feel insecure.
Well, and half of them are up to their neck in debt, too. But
there is something else. There is something else that I think is part of it. And that is when someone, like I used to have that lifestyle where it was just constant work as a programmer. And I find that when I was working so much, I didn't have time to develop those other aspects of my life, the other things that I believed in, the other things like music, art, culture, activism. And you'd be so tired that all you do is you come home, you watch television. And what I feel that happens is that you might as well go to work because there's nothing else happening out there. Yeah. That's how I used to feel. I don't mind an extra overtime. It's not like television is any good on a Saturday or a Sunday.
Yeah, and stress is a really big factor in our society as well. And I'm sure that's partly a result of all these long hours of work and nothing really enjoyable that you're involved in, that you really love to go and do, like gardening or maybe some craft, maybe painting or something. People don't have time for those kind of things that are relaxing.
Exactly. And what happened in my case was when I changed to a 4-day work week, and I had that extra day. It's a lot more than just an extra day. Because when you work 5 days, you have 1 day to recover and 1 day to do chores. Mm-hmm. When you change to a 4-day work week, this is what I found, is that I didn't need a day to recover because it wasn't all that 4 days is easy. Mm-hmm. So I had 3 days to do stuff.
Yeah. Now, you have an office. We're talking to Conrad Schmidt, and his YouTube video, which is a great success. It's, I think, about 16 minutes. It can be obtained by workersoftheworldrelax.org. Now, Conrad is saying that we should consume less and save the planet, and beauty and vitality are gifts of nature. You know, when we come back, we're just going to have a little musical interlude, and we don't have too much time left over. And then we're going to be talking about the growth of community gardens, because that's a part of getting closer to nature.
Exactly.
And last week we talked about bell peppers. Today we're going to talk a little bit about leeks. Leeks, L-E-E-K-E-S, K-K-S, not the ones you have in your roof and you don't want. These you want in your garden and you do want.
Thank you.
Yes, and we promised to talk about leeks, the kind that you would like to have. Anyway, yes, food prices have spiked, and the cost of food's going up, and people are growing community gardens. And last week we talked about bell peppers, and they need lots of sun. But you know, for our BC climate, the leek is really a wonderful vegetable. It's part of the alum family, and it is indeed what is classified as the mildest of all the allium, the garlic, onion variety of plants. Now, it is also has great cultural significance. It is the national emblem of Wales, and whose citizens wear it on St. David's Day. And in the play Henry tells Llewelyn that he is wearing a leek, for I am Welsh. You know, a good countryman, he is wearing the leek. So anyway, what I want to say about leeks is that you can buy them in little packs for about $1.69, and you get about 50 little plants. And you know, the glory of the leek is that you can harvest them in the fall, they're over winter, and then in the spring you'll have wonderful leeks. They'll grow in early spring in almost like frost-like conditions. They're putting out new leaves, which can be eaten and very tasty. And then in the summer, they'll put out the seeds, and they produce a beautiful little flower, which you can put in your garden and everything, and leave them in. And next week they're all. Alan tells me we don't have much time.
Time is leaking out.
Time is leaking out.
Leaking
and
away.
I will just finish off with our introduction. Ta-da! And we had it here. We had a wonderful quote from Gandhi, who said that there is little that separates humans from other sentient beings. We all feel pain. We all feel joy. We all deeply crave to be alive and to live freely. And we all share this a planet together. Thank you, Conrad Schmidt, for making us enjoy the life more.
Well, thank you very much. And it's always a great honor being on my favorite radio show.
And thank you for listening. Thank you, Alan and Marge.
It's 12:59, and we're going out with a bit of John Reichman here on the Animal Voices show. Coming up momentarily will be Radio Eco Shock, and that'll be followed at 2 o'clock by the Community Living Show, and at 2:30 by the A-Train Jazz to take you in the afternoon. And I'm sure you'll hear a lot about the upcoming Jazz Festival on the A-Train today. So stay tuned to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM and around the world on the Internet on co-opradio.org. And don't forget, there is an archive feature on our website, so you can go to cooperator.org, hit archives, and you can hear any of your favorite shows a second time.